Welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we bridge learning gaps and empower families to access the special education services they need. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I'm thrilled to kick off season 3 with you. Our podcast is your go-to resource for special education, offering expert insights, inspiring stories, and actionable tips to help your child thrive. In this season, we'll dive deeper into the world of special education. So whether you're a parent, educator, or passionate advocate, join us in this journey. To make this season unforgettable, please like, listen, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more families and create a stronger, more inclusive future. So hit that subscribe button, join our community, and let's make season 3 a game changer. Thanks to listeners like you. Hello and welcome. I look forward to having this conversation about speech and language services and as they relate to school. And we have Hallie with us today, and I'm going to have her say hello and introduce herself before we dive in.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. So I am Hallie Sherman. I am a speech language pathologist. I worked 16 years in the public schools here in New York. I actually just left in June to go full-time in my business of Speech Time Fun, where I create resources and do professional development for speech-language pathologists working with grades 4 through 12. But yeah, I just love working with children. I love the collaboration with other professionals. That's why I worked for so many years in the schools. And I'm all about just having fun and loving what you do each and every day.
That makes a big difference, right? When you love what you do, for sure, it makes a huge difference. And so I think this is a great conversation to have between us, because we're really talking about the role of a speech language pathologist within a school setting. And as an IEP coach on my end, talking to parents and coaching with professionals and talking about what related services are and where does that lie in an IEP. So I think this will be wonderful for you to kind of clarify all of these questions for folks that are listening. So how are speech language pathologists, let's just start, integrated to the broader special education framework?
Sure. So speech language pathologists can work in a variety of settings. So I'm going to start there. We could work in preschool, school-age children. We can work geriatrics, like NICU. You can work in hospitals, rehab centers. We can work anywhere. Our license covers us from birth to geriatric, and we can decide where we want to specialize in our practice. I chose to work in a school because I love the collaboration. I love that age group. I love being that big piece of the puzzle that really helps students succeed academically and really flourish. But in order to get, this is one of the areas where we get a lot of questions is, okay, you know, I don't understand this child. Shouldn't he just get speech? And there is a difference, even though we are certified just no matter what setting, we are qualified to do whatever. It's the rules and regulations and the funding that kind of has our hands tied. So to get services in a clinic or outpatient, you have concerns, you get evaluated, and that therapist determines yes or no, is it warranted? And oftentimes, if you're willing to pay for it, you can get whatever you want. Like as long as it's not, you know, based on insurance funding, Medicare funding, all that fun stuff, if you're willing to pay out of pocket, you can get the service so that you can improve on whatever weaknesses you are feeling are there. In a school setting, however, there are, under the IDEA, in order to get services in a school, it has to be adversely impacting the student's academics. So it has to be impacting their ability to access the curriculum or function in a school setting. So that's where oftentimes it's like, but they need speech. Why are they not getting it? It's, well, they might need speech, but it might not be causing them to not succeed in the classroom. Yes, we want them to be perfect. We want them to be understood clearly, things like that. So oftentimes in the school setting, those receiving services are typically more language-based services because language is such an integral part of being able to access the curriculum. In order to be a successful reader, we know they need to have adequate vocabulary, adequate listening comprehension, sentence structure, being able to answer questions. That's typically what SLPs are usually working on in the school setting. So that is where, okay, why are they getting services there? Why are they not? What, you know, I was told no. This is typically why. It's not that we want to be bad cop. Oftentimes, our hands are tied. We would love to help everyone, but that if we help everyone, we're helping no one, first of all. And also, districts are not going to get more funding to hire more speech pathologists if the need isn't there and documented in the paperwork.
So let's just step back for a second. And can you identify, or can you talk about the difference between speech and language, right? So you're considered a speech and language pathologist, but I think those two terms can get confusing.
Mm-hmm. So our scope of practice is we can work on any form of communication from articulation, vocabulary, sentence structure. Oh my goodness, everything under the sun. We work with those with a stutter, anything that can be. So speech is typically, when we think of speech, we think of articulation, the inability of creating, producing sounds. And that could impact their ability to function in schools, typically when it's more severe, when they really cannot be understood, when it is impacting their ability to demonstrate their understanding in the classroom and being able to participate, and maybe social emotionally because of social interactions with their peers, then yes. So and also stuttering, also there is that fine line, like, is it impacting them academically? So oftentimes we're like, yes, there is a need, but is it needed in the schools? And then the language piece is, okay, then that vocabulary, sentence structure, being able to answer questions, formulating sentences, using proper grammar structures, all that, being able to critically think and do higher level thinking skills, all that falls under the language piece.
Perfect. And so let's talk about, when we talk about an IEP, because we kind of started there, right? We talked about getting services. What does that look like? So for, say, a parent requests to have their child be evaluated for special education services, why does speech and language go under related services within an IEP? Sometimes we get that question also.
Under an IEP, there's typically like a program, which is typically the classroom setting if you need self-contained and integrated co-teaching classroom. And then a related service is the support that is needed on top of that. So we aren't a classroom, we are a support service. And that is why we're in addition to. So in order to get speech and language in the schools, it has to be determined by the evaluation results, by the committee, that there is a deficit in the receptive and expressive language or whatever causing the speech and language difficulties, and that it is also adversely impacting the academics. That said, then there are times where a student might only get speech. They might not be in a program because there might not be an academic need that warrants more restrictive environments. But being pulled for the just speech is actually considered like the least restrictive environment, which is always our ideal. We want our students in the classrooms as much as possible. That is also another reason why, in order to get speech services, it has to be warranted. We can't just pull students out of their classroom. Like, that's not deemed necessary. So once that the determination is there based on the evaluation, then a speech language pathologist would be recommending services, adding it to the IEP, and creating present levels of performance, determining needs that are warranted, and then goals based on those needs.
So as a speech language pathologist in a school, oftentimes, I don't know what your district looked like, but there are many districts where an SLP will be in charge of different schools. They may be in one building a couple days a week and another building a couple days a week. So without that consistency, what have you seen to be the best to facilitate collaboration? Because your role is really, you're going to be collaborating with the parent, obviously, of the child that you're serving, but also probably the special educator, the general educator, you know, other folks in the building. So what have you seen work really well to help facilitate that communication and collaboration of service providers in a building?
One is that the respect and understanding that we would love to be in the building all the time and being able to be there all the time, but we have restraints. We are given tasks by higher ups and we are just told what to do. If there's not enough students in that building to warrant a person full time, it is just, unfortunately, what it is. We also are typically given extremely large caseloads. I had in my district, I stopped counting after 60, and I was in one building, and I was the only speech pathologist in the building. So anyone who needed services, it was me. And I could only be in one place and at one time. And literally in between sessions, I was trying to either clean up, set up, prepare, grab students, and maybe run to the bathroom if that was even an option. And so often, we feel terrible when someone wants to stop and talk to us about a particular student. We might just not have that time. So recognizing that we would love to, however, like email is and text messaging, like whatever the form of communication then is going to work, is going to be your best friend. And having that open dialogue and recognizing you're both in want the same thing. You both want your students to succeed. It's not who got there, who was able to make them succeed. It's not a competition. It's not, oh, they're making my job more difficult for me. And this can go both ways. It is we're both in this for the same purpose. So let's work together. So if the speech pathologist is pulling the student out at not an ideal time, it's not because we want to just make things difficult for you. It's that is just the only time we have. And it just, we're sorry. We can't please all 65 teachers we are working with when we might be in different buildings on a different day. This is just the day they are there. We would love to, we would if we could. But like, we just need to work with us to like understand that we're just trying to do our best here to make it work. And then if they do, and feel free to share what is working in your classroom with that student. Where are the students struggling? Let us know the successes you're having with them. We want to hear that too. If you finally get your student to do X, Y, and Z, whether it might be math related. It might be like a writing an essay. It might have nothing to do with their like speech goals. Let us know. We're not mind readers. We want to hear these things too, and we can't guess. We can ask the students, "Hey, how's it going?" But most of the time, we are given crickets by them. We are reported nothing on what they're doing in the classroom. So anytime you can give us information, if you're making like worksheets, throw a copy of them in our mailbox. If we have a mailbox in like the school, office. Give us a copy of the test that's coming up. Give us a copy of the vocabulary list. Most of the time we are given zero. We are never given a curriculum map. We are never told what's going on. We are in the dark most of the time. So just assume anything you give us is appreciated. We're not offended by it. We want to hear what's going on in your classroom. And then on the flip side, if we share like a strategy that's working with us, in the speech room, we're not trying to give you extra work. We're not trying to tell you how to do your job. We really just want our students to be able to carry over the skill in the classroom and try to succeed. You might be doing it already, but like, let us share what's working with us so that we can both be on the same page. And again, see that student succeed.
What has worked when communicating with parents for you in particular?
Having that open dialogue in the beginning of the year and knowing that every parent wants to communicate differently. When I worked in a preschool setting, the students had notebooks every day, and I made sure that I brought it with me and wrote at least something in the notebook. This way, if the parent wants to communicate with the teacher on a regular basis, I'm going to be participating in that communication as well. As they get older, it's typically not as common to have that regular communication, even with the classroom teachers. I'm going to have just that same. I always send a letter in the beginning of the year, so parents have. When I had a phone extension, they had my phone number, they had my email address, and I always try to show them like, I am available if you have any questions. And then on top of that, based on the IEP, and every district and state has different regulations, but you have to have those quarterly IEP reports, progress reports sent home. So that's another opportunity that I'm sending home 4 times a year, how that student is doing. So you have information. And I always say, if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. And then I'm also always a part of the annual IEP process. So parents always see me, and I'm always a face if they have any questions.
So for parents that are listening, and even professionals, right? I always kind of talk about data collection, and we talk about annual IEP and present levels of performance. Do you have any tips that you have found easy or to make your job easier in terms of data collection? Because we know parents want to look at raw data sheets and just really see kind of what's happening. And so I always try to ask our professionals that are in school buildings tips and tricks when it comes to that.
So as part of our job requirement, it's part of good practice. We're always taking data. It might not be all session every session because we want to be able to teach the students and also help them and support them. If we're taking data the entire time, we're not teaching them and we're testing them. That's not why they're with us. That said, we are on a regular basis checking the progress of their IEP goal. So there's always data, especially if they're doing billing and things like that. There is data somewhere, whether it's on a digital, there's many SLPs that use some digital tools. There's some paper-based tools. I was a binder girl. I loved taking data in a binder. I was a sticky note person, what have you.
Me too.
I find though, more than the tally mark, like parents could ask for the tally marks. That's not going to tell them anything. I can easily say, yeah, they did it 4 out of 5 times or 80% of the session. My data that's so much more important is that anecdotal data. How were they able to achieve that score or that task? How much assistance did I need to provide them? What strategies did I teach them in order for them to be successful? What length and complexity of a text did I provide them that allowed them to be successful or unsuccessful? That's so much more important. That's something I always share in my reports and things like that that go into the decision making for the next IEP. And that's always what I share more to parents than, okay, they did it 4 out of 5 times. Because that tells you nothing. That's great that they made progress. In the beginning, they did it 1 out of 4, but then 1 out of 5. And at the end of the year, they did it 5 out of 5. But what was needed in order for them to get there? What strategies did I have to teach them? What things were in place or not in place? What maybe promptings and models were able to be removed? So maybe they're not doing as great, but I was giving them less prompting and they're doing it more independently. So knowing more about what does the data mean is more important than the data itself.
And I like how you describe that because it is, I was also a sticky note binder gal in the realm of special education as a case manager. But I think it's important, very much so, of what you just said in terms of what does that mean and what kind of scaffolding went around that student's outcome. Because from that information, a parent or professional can then help curate and develop more so that individualized educational program and making sure that the right accommodations, modifications are put into place and services and goals are really outlined in that manner. So when we talk about special education services, we kind of just hopped in and went right for it. Can we talk a little bit about what types of assessments do SLPs typically utilize and how can then we translate those results?
Sure. So we are always required to do some sort of formal battery and get some sort of standardized results. And there's different tools out there. There's the SELF, the Clinical Evaluation Language Fundamentals. There's the TOLE, there's the OWLS. You might see all these different acronyms, all these different tools out there that give us a very comprehensive overview of the student's receptive and expressive language skills. Now, if there is a need for articulation, we might do the Gulman-Fristo, the Arizona. There's other batteries out there that give us a standardized result and score. And then, but more importantly, also, we are always doing informal assessments, dynamic assessments, so we can truly determine, yes, great, these standardized evaluations are just one piece of the puzzle that sometimes we need those numbers to determine, okay, will we get that funding or not? Is this student going to qualify? But also we like to learn about, okay, their capability of learning. If I teach it to them and they're able to grasp it using dynamic assessment, if I do like a test, teach, retest, if they're able to grasp it in that little of a time, I can give that strategy to the teacher and let's keep that student in the classroom. They're capable of learning. They just need more support. There's not a need for that service, that individualized service and program. So yes, we need the standardized test results. And then again, you know, there is some different regulations and things like that, but we always look at, you know, how many standard deviations below the mean. Typically there's some sort of criteria mark based on a bell curve. So typically it's lower than the 16th percentile or 85th standard score or 7th scale score. It typically means that you are below average and warrant services, depending on how severe and how, depending on the different batteries. And like a student might score poorly on one subtest, but that's it. And that might not be enough to indicate that there is a need. And that's why in the informal assessment, dynamic assessment, we get to go a little bit deeper on what that student is needing from us versus just some standardized results.
So if a parent is requesting an evaluation, right, like they're writing a letter to the school, my child has educational impacts in these areas, I'm concerned, I'd like to move forward with an evaluation. What tips do you have for parents if speech and language is part of that concern?
To be
and
part
like
of,
requesting that evaluation?
Most of the time, we're part of the determination, part of the initial evaluation process. Sometimes I'm called in later. So sometimes it could be the educational evaluation or the psychological evaluation that shows some red flags. Both the educational and the psychological evaluation does have some language components. It's not as thorough as our evaluation, but does sometimes show some red flags like, okay, this could be an indicator of why they are struggling in the classroom. Let's bring in the speech language pathologist to go a little deeper. And our evaluation is a lot more comprehensive. So there are times where sometimes the special education evaluation and the psychological evaluation says that there might be some language vocabulary deficits, but then ours are more like, okay, they don't have a deficit in their capabilities. It might be their academic vocabulary or there also are other aspects that could be attention. There's all these other factors that could come into play. English language learners, there's so many other factors that could make it appear that there might be a language need, but our evaluation might not determine that. So once it is determined that the student does require the service, we provide the parent with an evaluation report. You have access to it, typically have to be get access to it before the meetings. You can review it ahead of time. And then also especially if it's an annual review meeting, like determine the IEP, making the determination ahead of time. We've already written the IEP. We've already written the goals. So you are already presented with our recommendations, and that's your opportunity to ask questions, give your input, and it's always welcomed and encouraged.
Well, I will say I like how you, because it's really a recommendation, because we can't predetermine anything. So when a parent gets that IEP in advance, know for parents that it's their baseline to start asking questions and develop from there. What would you like parents to know when it comes to understanding the assessments that you provide?
Yeah,
it's like a lot of scores, right? And then they're thinking, well, I don't even know what this means. Does this mean that they can do it? They can't do it? What should I ask for? Like, what are some tips in that?
Look at the summary. Start there. See, you can tell by the summary what they're going to be recommending at the meeting. And typically, I know I always write my reports like, okay, I'll give the numbers. And then next would I'll say like average, like below average. So I give some sort of like quick little like indicator, but you can always tell by the summary on the conclusions of what they are going to be recommending. And then write a list of questions, come in with saying, what does this mean? What does this mean? There are different styles. I've sat with many professionals that would go score by score at a meeting. And I started to lose focus. Like, I'm like, I can't pay attention to this. Like, what does it mean? So my style and the meaning is, okay, these were the strengths, these were the weaknesses, and this is my recommendation. I try to give it short, sweet, and to the point, because there's a lot of numbers. There's a lot of things on there. But what does that mean for your child? What does this indicate, like, how they are doing well or not well, or their ability or not, like, what does this mean? If someone is too short and sweet to the point like me and you want to know more, we welcome you to ask. If someone is giving you a lot of information, at the end you could say, so what does this mean? Feel free to ask questions. We encourage it. We'd rather not talk and you just sit there thinking you have to listen and not, some people speak a lot more jargon and terminology. I like to keep it very parent friendly. There's just different styles. But feel free that you are able and welcomed to ask for what things mean. What does this mean for your child? We don't want you leaving there more confused.
And I think the short and sweet is a great approach, right? And most parents are like, okay, great. Here's my strengths, pockets of vulnerability, and what are our recommendations and how do we support? And then, if they need to dive deeper, let's do it. But I have been in so many meetings where I'm kind of nodding over here, just where it's line by line by line, and you can see the parents are just overwhelmed and glazed over, and it's like, what are we doing with this information? So that is really helpful to kind of make those reports succinct so that a parent can understand it, and even other professionals so that they can understand it, right? But how can we encourage parents to actively participate in that review process, or where do you see some tips for the role that they play, and whether it's adjusting speech language goals or just kind of overall student progress?
They know their child best. We only have a portion of their day or week with them. They might see how they're struggling with homework. They might see the years of frustration that they might have with coming to school and learning and things like that. Share that with us. We want to hear those pieces of information and your experiences. We might be able to help and give you some suggestions that can help with homework. Maybe we can even make a recommendation, a modification that they get shortened, simplified homework assignments. Like there's so many things that when we know more, we can help more. Being able to share with us what's going on and what you see. And maybe the child is reporting things at home, how things are going in the classroom and their struggles. And we want to hear about that. And that will help us make a recommendation that will be most individualized for them. Yeah, just encouraging just to share things with us, the wins, not the wins, what works, what didn't work. Maybe this student might be new on our caseload. Maybe they've worked with a different professional in the past. Share those experiences with us. Share what, again, what worked, what didn't work. We want to hear. And just, we're a team. Just knowing it is all a team. It's not us telling you what to do. It's all of us trying to work together to, and if we say that something is not needed, that's actually a good thing. Like it's okay. That's a great thing. So the word I sometimes like I go into meetings on eggshells. Like the student is about to like graduate from speech, that the parent's gonna like, and I'm like, that's a good thing that they don't need me anymore. Don't be mad.
No, I think sometimes parents look at it as a safety net, though, like you're their binky. And so, even with educational therapy and tutoring and stuff, sometimes parents, their babies are ready to go. They've learned the strategies, but I think sometimes it's just a comfort to have us around. So I can certainly identify with that. What does a typical session for speech language pathologists in a school setting look like if you are a pulled out versus like push in?
Sure. So a pull-out setting is like the student will come either individually or in a group determined by the IEP and their needs or availability. And they would go into a therapy setting, whether it's large or small, and they would be working with all the students in the group to be working on their individual goals, but as a group setting. So they're able to get the models of each other, learn from each other. There's the camaraderie of realizing they're not alone. I've heard that's my, honestly, my personal favorite structure is because I get to work in isolation on those individual skills that will help them then transfer into the classroom where it might not be easily done in the classroom setting when there's so many other things going on. So if they need that individualized isolated support, learning a new skill, practicing a new skill, that would be done in the therapy room. And it would be all based on their IEP goals, not the next kid's IEP goals. The speech pathologist might be using one book, one activity with all the different students, but targeting all of their different needs at the exact same time. And then, so it might be one time a week, two times a week, depending on the severity and complexity of the needs, would you determine the amount of times they would be pulled. Again, least restrictive environment. We're trying to keep them in the classroom as much as possible. So it's not us saying, like, we would love to help and give them speech all day, every day. We really need them in the classroom as much as possible because then they're going to fall even farther behind. So that is one option. The other is a push-in setting. And that's typically more when they're ready for that carryover piece, when getting pulled out to work, they've mastered it in the pull-out setting, but now it's time to carry it over into the classroom. So the speech pathologist is there to support the teacher and to support the student be able to access the curriculum and participate in the class activities with the support of the speech language pathologist there. In an ideal setting, they are come in planning time and they've planned it all out together and they know exactly what each other are going to do and finish each other's sentences in a completely ideal world. And then another area where some SLPs might recommend is like a consult basis. And that's when they don't even need the push in anymore. It's literally, it's either consult. Typically, And it would be written on different parts of the IEP. It would either be a consult with the student. Let me just check in with them, see how they're doing, remind them of their strategies. Or it could be a consult of the teacher. And that's usually written under like supports for the teacher, wouldn't be like under related service. And that would be just making sure the teacher is aware of the different supports that that student needs to be able to be successful. So the student doesn't need that isolated, individualized support anymore. It's the teacher can provide that support, just they might need the help of the speech pathologist to make sure that happens.
Before we jumped on recording, I got off the phone with a parent, and it just makes sense to ask you this question. She asked me, why do they always recommend 30 minutes of speech per week? So I'm going to ask you
like
that
question. Why the 30 versus like 40 or?
Yes, correct. And I was like, yeah, you know, I do. There is a theme with that.
I don't really. There is a rationale because it's like two times as like an hour. I don't really know. Typically, it's like the class periods. Like if you look at like a school schedule, like it's like, okay, like what's a period? It might be 40 minutes, but like it's not the whole thing. I'm sure there's some real, that's a really good question. Like there, that's just like the standard. I don't know. Like I might, and the only time I've ever seen more than that is one time I did work in a middle school and high school and I was a part of their schedule. So it was like the 40 minutes because it was the on the schedule.
And then what would make your determination, I know it's a team determination in terms of, you kind of touched on it, like push out versus pull in, no, pull out versus push in, get that, versus consult, kind of where would you like to see, do you have in your mind of like, okay, when a student gets to this point, then they can graduate to this next level?
It's more like when they've mastered everything they could in that one setting. We don't want to keep pulling them out of class. We want them to stay in as much as possible. Again, I keep saying it, the least restrictive environment. We don't want them to come. We love them. We don't want them to come with us. We want them to stay in the classroom. So as much as possible, if it's not needed to work on these skills in a separate location, if they can be learned indirectly within the constructs of the class activities, we would prefer to keep them in the classroom as much as possible.
So digging into your best practice toolbox, what are some strategies that or activities that you really have found kind of gold standard in meeting the unique needs of students, but also accounting for diverse learning styles?
I love graphic organizers. I find that oftentimes they're given like you teaching students not just what to do, but how to do it. So like I always, when I teach SLPs how to use graphic organizers, I'm like, if I can just give that graphic organizer to that child and they can be successful, I can just give that to the teacher. That can be just like a RTI strategy. I need to teach them explicitly how to utilize it. So teaching them to listen for the different key items to fill out that graphic organizer. Also, there is a ton of evidence that shows graphic organizers help with like processing overload and memory. There's all these different areas. So it's my favorite strategy to implement. And it's something that just goes, teachers are used to doing that in the classroom anyway. So it's something that can easily be carried over. But then also teaching my students to self-advocate and be aware of what they need. So asking for repetition, asking for help, recognizing when they need that support and need to hear something again, they don't understand what a word means, and utilizing all their different strategies. So yeah, like even teaching students like to check for their understanding. So like they just read something, do you not understand? Let's read it again before we keep going. Just all those different techniques help them be more aware. And then also getting them those quick wins so that they can feel successful.
What are some good advocacy strategies that you've taught kiddos? Because that's huge, right? Advocacy for that, for your, as an individual.
It depends on the age of the student, but for the older ones, I like them to be aware of their modifications and accommodations, especially when they get into that middle school and high school level, when they have 9 teachers that might not be all, especially in the beginning of the year, acclimated to their IEP plan. So like, hey, I'm supposed to get extra time on this test. It's okay to say that. You know, I'm allowed to take this in a different room. I'm allowed to say that. You know, my teacher put me in the back of the room. I can't see the board. I can't hear her well. I can say something. And it's not being rude. It's not being disrespectful. Like they can advocate for themselves. So that's something I always instructed and encouraged my students to do. And then also teaching them their different learning styles, that every student learns differently, and that doesn't make them worse or better. It makes the world go round. So then being aware that, okay, they might need a quiet space. They might need a noisier space. They might need to stand up. They might need frequent breaks. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with them.
And I've always found it helpful too, to kind of role play with a student so that they can get comfortable with saying those things out loud has really helped. Or I've seen a growth with that for sure. Can you talk about transition planning, right? So as we get into middle school and high school and just moving between grade levels and educational settings, where do you see the role of an SLP in ensuring that continuity of support through transitions?
We like to be a part of the, especially as they get older and the vocational training and the vocational needs are there. I'm not sure if this is everywhere, but in like New York, I think it's after 12th, sixth grade or something. Like that's part of the IEP is the mentioning of like what job do they want? Where are they, like what's their future goals? And we want to be a part of that. We need to be aware. This way we can incorporate these goals that they have into our therapy sessions. It shouldn't always be just academically based. If they want to be X, Y, and Z when they grow up, or this is where they see and what they want out of life, we can help encourage that and support that within our speech and language sessions.
What type of resources then are available that you have seen for the support of that transition, whether it's transition from middle to high or high school to post-secondary or whatever that student is pursuing?
There's a lot out there. There's a lot of like job training type resources out there. I've seen like mock interviewing and applications so they can practice that at their, like, and get used to all those things at home. Just learning about different jobs that are available to them. And even them being aware that, like, I love that as they get older, they're part more of the IEP writing process. A lot of times they're encouraged to come to the IEP meetings so that they can, it's not, okay, what are they talking about? It's like they get to share, okay, you know, this is where I'm struggling. And so I encourage parents and like incorporate and bring your child in. I've had many teachers work with their students to help create like a little presentation, and the parents and the child presents at the IEP meeting, like, these are my strengths, these are my weaknesses, this is what I want to get out of school and what I want to be when I grow up. And I love seeing that participation. So there's tons of resources out there that you can Google in terms of job options and training, vocational training resources and things like that. But just encourage, like even the different like quizzes and things that they can like learn what using their skills, what like they might not be aware of like certain jobs out there, and that could help determine their goals and with their path. So bringing them a part of the process.
Yeah. And I think we don't, at least in our area, and us professionals have talked a lot about this in terms of trade schools and technical schools don't get a lot of conversation, I think, as they should, because, you know, college isn't for everyone. So doing what you're saying is just really helping identify areas that a student may be interested in that they may not even realize that that's an option for gainful employment, right? So the whole idea of a IEP is that future education, independence, and employment. So starting that and having those conversations and bringing in folks like you as a related service provider to help broaden and deepen the understanding for that student is incredible. There's actually a location here, it's called College Living Experience, but it is throughout the United States. And when you talked about mock interviews, it made me think I volunteer in the springtime and the students do mock interviews. And it's really empowering for the student, because if you've never done an interview, right, it's really nerve-wracking. And so to be able to sit with somebody that's an adult, that's a professional, to have that experience of, you know, what are your strengths and what are you going to provide for this organization? And just those kind of questions that they've probably thought about and discussed, but then to talk with somebody and practice, I think, is a really neat way to gain some skills.
And you never know, some districts and areas might have some sort of programs that they either have in their school or they can send students to. Like, there are some like beautician programs that like high school students have access to, or different types of trade school, like mechanics,
automotive in our district, and they have cosmetology and electrician. They have quite a bit. And I think just starting to normalize those conversations is really important so that students can see that there's many options out there to create a fulfilling life.
We want them to go to school for a purpose and see the value of like their education and where it can get them. And if they don't have that intrinsic motivation, like no matter what we do, it won't be worth it. So.
Excellent. So I just kind of jumped in when we hit go on recording, and I normally ask my guests, so I'm going to ask you now, what is one fun thing that people may not know about you that really is not necessarily related to speech and language?
Okay, I will share. I actually wrote a children's book, Ella Bella Just Can't Tell You. It's on Amazon. It was a little passion project. I'm a one-hit wonder. I keep saying I will write another one, but it was something I always just wanted to do. I always dreamed of having a children's book, and that's just something fun that I just did as well.
So sweet. So sweet. And then kind of as we wind down, what is something that I did not ask you or I didn't know enough to ask you that you think we should have chatted about?
Get asked a lot of them. I shared the different roles of speech and language pathologists in schools and not schools. Just that we are part of this process. And we have the best interests of the students we work with, and we want to be a part of the team. And yeah, feel free to include us. We are here as a support. There's tons of speech and language pathologists on social media if you ever have any questions, including myself. And yeah, I'm happy to always answer any questions that anyone might have.
My final question I always ask my guest as well is if you had a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
Oh my goodness, this is so hard. I'm trying to think of something very speechy. Have fun. Just
I
have
like
fun.
that.
Just have fun.
Have fun. Absolutely. And that's really the name of your business. Speech time fun.
You gotta make it fun. Learning can be tough, and things can be tough sometimes, but if you always have a smile on your face, you never know who might need it at the moment.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much for joining me today and having this conversation and just kind of bringing to focus the role of a speech language pathologist specifically in a school building. So I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Thank you again for tuning into another episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you found today's podcast insightful and valuable. Before we sign off, remember to show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to our podcast. Your engagement helps us continue our mission of empowering families and bridging learning gaps in special education. Don't forget to spread the word about the Special Ed Strategist podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who may benefit from our content. Together, we can make a difference in the lives of children with special needs. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I can't wait to bring you more inspiring content in the future. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep making a positive impact. Goodbye for now.